Good morning. This is Lael Arrington, co-hosting today with Sue Stewart, who is in for Rick Davis, who's on hiatus this week. Sue, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Lael.
And you're welcome to the Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about things that everyone is passionate about, but that matter a whole lot more than sports or politics. And certainly something that everyone feels passionate about at this holiday time of year is the pleasure of special times with special friends and family, the warmth of coming home to a house all aglow. But so many of us may find that our holiday stories don't read that way. The very relationships we long to celebrate during the holidays may be broken or lost, or we can go through the holiday motions with a great sense of loneliness or even an emptiness beyond loneliness. For many of us, simply the pace, the stress of meeting all these expectations can actually work against us, draining our enjoyment. Author Douglas Copeland described that numbness in his book, Life After God, and he said, "I've been losing my ability to feel things with the same intensity, the way I felt when I was younger. It's scary to feel your emotions floating away and just not caring. Loneliness had become an emotion I had stopped feeling so intensely. I'd learned loneliness as extremes and realized it was no longer new or frightening, just another aspect of life that once identified seemed to disappear. But I realized the capacity for not feeling lonely carried a very real price, which was the threat of feeling nothing at all." Our guest today, Dr. Arch Hart, will help us understand the psychology and the physiology of what makes us feel good and what robs us of our joy during this season or any season, and how we can purposefully reclaim it. Dr. Archibald Hart is a clinical psychologist and senior professor of psychology and dean emeritus of the Graduate School of Psychology at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena, California. He also serves as the president of the International Network for Christian Counselors and is the author of 24 books, including Adrenaline and Stress, Stress and Your Child, The Anxiety Cure, and the focus of today's interview, his latest book, Thrilled to Death, How the Endless Pursuit of Pleasure is Leaving Us Numb. And welcome to the Things That Matter Most, Dr. Hart.
Yes,
thank
welcome,
you very
Dr.
much, Lael.
Yes.
And Sue, good to
be
with you.
Good to be with you, too.
Yes. Well, Dr. Hart, you begin your book by writing, "Compared to the ease with which, say, our grandparents were able to find delight in relatively low stimulating activities, it now takes an enormously high level of stimulation to deliver us just a modicum, just a nugget of enjoyment." So why, Dr. Hart, why in a nut, just a nut, do you think that is?
Well, it boils down mainly to the fact that in my grandparents' days, and quite frankly, in the early part of my own life, the level of stimulation that I experienced was not beyond the limits of my wonderful brain's capacity to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, we have in the last few decades increased the level of excitement, excessive stimulation in the lives of all of us, but particularly in the lives of our children and teenagers,
mm-hmm.
to the point where the brain is not handling it very well. It really does boil down to a change that is affecting what's going on in our brains.
It's like trying to process like a million gigawatts of information with a Pentium 1 processor or something.
Too much excitement, Dr. Hart, too much excitement is not a good thing.
No. We now see excitement as a dangerous drug. That's what Dennis Prager, a well-known radio host, mm-hmm. called it a little while ago. It is a dangerous drug. It's like a drug in that it creates in us a level of excitement that, as in all addictions, means that the next time around I must have more excitement. I'm not satisfied with that. The brain never goes back to the place where it is getting no excitement so it can reestablish its normal baseline.
Mm. Well,
it is constantly having to adjust upwards.
Well, psychologists, as you pointed out, have a clinical word to describe those feelings that Douglas
yes.
Copeland described that I read in the intro of the show, that feeling of feeling your emotions floating away and just not caring, or the threat of feeling nothing at all. And maybe
right.
you could explain that concept and that word to our audience.
Yes. The word is anhedonia. Hedonism, we know that means pleasure, and when you put A-N in front of it, it means no pleasure. And so the phenomenon that is one, it's called anhedonia. Now, in earlier times, we used this phrase to describe certain mental disorders. If you were severely depressed, one of the symptoms is anhedonia, the inability to experience pleasure in the little things of your life.
And you know what's really...
other mental disorders as well.
Right.
But it's not until fairly recently that we are beginning to realize that there is a profound anhedonia in our culture, particularly in our youth, where they are slowly losing the capacity to experience pleasure in little things. Let me give you an example. When I was a teenager, my young the wife I was dating then, and I loved to go on picnics. Boy, we would pack a basket and we'd go and find, I come from South Africa, so we could find some nice, interesting places to go for picnics. The other day, I was talking to my grandchildren, my grandsons now in their early 20s and some still in their teenage years, and I said to them, hey, how about us going on a picnic? All
I can see this coming.
they looked at me with bewilderment. Huh?
The deer in the headlights.
There a mall nearby was one of my granddaughters. What excites young people today is no longer what used to excite us in earlier eras of our lives.
You know, it was so interesting, Dr. Hart. I was working on this interview, reading your book and thinking about the questions, and there was an episode of House on TV. Yes, I was watching TV and working on questions. I was sucked in.
Multitasking.
I'm a goner.
There you go.
I'm a goner.
Multitasking.
Yes. And the diagnosis was anhedonia.
Anhedonia.
I just poked up.
And you knew what
that
was.
Yes, I poked up, and the people there on the screen were just totally straight-faced. They were not,
yes.
There was no ever a smile. There was never a frown. It was just their face was a blank slate. And it reminded me of the way you described it in your book where you had a quote from a fellow that says, my food seems tasteless. A beautiful woman no longer attracts me. Music no longer pleases me. Mm-hmm. I don't care if I ever go to a movie again. My friends seem dull. I look forward to nothing. I don't want to die, but I don't care about living. I don't get a kick out of anything except perhaps making some big deal come to reality. Now, as a psychologist who works with young people, how do you see it impacting their future?
Well, the first problem that is developing is that we are now seeing a form of depression that we'd really not noticed before. Mm. There's a form of depression now where the only symptom is anhedonia, the inability to experience pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, in the classic depressions, we think of it as someone who's crying, they're very sad, they're down
they
in
the
dumps.
They feel sad.
But now there's a form of depression with anhedonia. All you have is this loss of ability to experience pleasure in little things.
Mm.
And it is it's becoming a standard for teenagers. And I will often in a seminar ask the audience, what is the most common phrase you hear from your teenagers today? And I am not exaggerating. Within an instant, 100 names will go up. And it's the phrase, I'm bored.
Oh,
I'm bored.
I've heard that. With my six children, I've heard that from time to time.
Well, and it was very sobering as I read in your book when you said that you predicted for these young people that perhaps that deriving pleasure from the ordinary healthy experiences of life will become a thing of the past, and they may come to rely almost entirely on psychotropic medications for feel happy. And I thought, that is a very sobering prediction.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Hart, I have a question for you, sort of springboard off of that. I'm very interested in the different types of personalities, and there are some personalities that just naturally pessimistic and prone to depression. And I'm wondering, how does anhedonia figure in with how those people process experience? Are they does their natural pessimism sort of exacerbate with an anhedonic experience, or are they, how does that work for those people who
Interesting question, because obviously if you have a personality that is pessimistic, negative, and so on, the anhedonia is going to make those characteristics worse. But this phenomenon cuts right across all personalities. Those who are more optimistic, outgoing, normally, you know, happy, you're lucky sort of people, are the ones who are experiencing the phenomenon more devastatingly than others. In other words, if you have a negative personality, you're probably not going to notice it as easily, because it's your standard state of existence. And, you know, generally speaking, young people today, I don't see as many negative personalities as I used to earlier. I think we've become a little more optimistic in our outlook. But the problem is, it's the level to which you're going to suffer from this phenomenon. Your personality will have an effect there.
Well, Dr. Hart, we're interviewing Dr. Hart, author of Thrilled to Death: How the Endless Pursuit of Pleasure is Leaving Us Numb, here on The Things That Matter Most. And please tell us about the physiology of pleasure. What does research tell us about how the brain processes pleasure, or how the brain can be blocked from processing pleasure?
Yes, I think that's very important. If you're going to understand what's happening here, you need to understand what it is in the brain that is being affected by all of this. We know now, and have known for since about the middle of the 1950s, that the brain has a very specific center for pleasure. The technical label is locus accumbens, but you don't have to worry about fancy names. The locus means that it's located in one place. There is a specific part of the brain that gives us pleasure. So when I sit down, I made a delicious curry the day before yesterday, I might say. You know, I'm sorry I couldn't share some with you both, but I love curries, and I'm always experimenting with recipes. And 2 days ago, I made, it was fantastic, you know, absolutely fantastic. And as I sat down to enjoy the meal, I could just feel the pleasure. Now, that pleasure feeling is coming from a center of the brain. It's not an imagined thing. It is a physiologically based thing. There's a neurotransmitter called dopamine that is becoming well-known today because it's been implicated in addictions. It's been implicated in love, in sex, and so on. And this is the neurotransmitter that carries the message to the center, telling it, hey, enjoy it, pleasure, this is pleasurable. And when you flood that system, and that's what's happening today, there's just too much excitement in everybody else's life. By that I mean overstimulation, overactivity, involvement, iPods, iPhones, constant internet, text blogging, and so on. When you overload that pleasure system, it gradually begins to build up a resistance. You are changing its baseline, and slowly, only the more exciting things will become pleasurable for you. And we call that the addictive process. We see it in cocaine addiction, in all drugs that provide pleasure, that are stimulation based. We see this phenomenon, this flooding of the pleasure system, that then means that the only thing that can give you pleasure is something that is bigger than that last little bit of pleasure you had. And that's what we mean. Anhedonia means that there is flooding of this pleasure system.
Okay. And so the threshold for a pleasurable impulse is not registered as readily, is what you're saying.
It's going up all the time.
Okay.
And we know in addiction, for example, that a certain level of a drug will give you pleasure, but when you keep it at that level in a week or two, the brain is no longer going to get any pleasure, so you have to keep upping the ante. You've got to keep upping the drug. And this phenomenon is in all addictions. And it's because that the system, the threshold for pleasure in the brain is being raised all the time.
Okay.
Take for example, well, a good example of this, the fabulous iPhone that came out a little while ago,
uh-huh.
and I all my grandsons went for these iPhones, you know, and oh boy, for the first week or two, they were having fun, they were having so much pleasure, but by the third week, they were lying in a drawer, they were hardly touching the thing.
Well, and we're heading into Christmas, and what parent has not really seen that law of diminishing returns or, you know,
yes.
the set in, the same effect take place of the kids that are so delighted at first, and then isn't every toy or most toys,
sure.
I mean, isn't that the way it normally is? Well, it's about time to take a break, but when we come back from the break, Dr. Hart, I would very much love your reaction or your response to just a continuing conversation that we have on our show. And we've interviewed both Deepak Chopra, a wellness author and Eastern sort of New Age perspective author, who's also a medical doctor, though, and J.P. Moreland, a Christian philosopher. And one thing that they both would agree on, while they would probably disagree on a lot of things, is that they would say that we don't feel pain or pleasure in our brains. We feel it in our consciousness, our souls, the immaterial inner being. And I would love to have your response to that when we come back from the break. This is Leah Larrington.
And Sue Stewart.
And we'll be back on The Things That Matter Most in just a moment.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. Do you have trouble remembering to tune us in on Sunday mornings at 9? Well, the pressure's off because we have three ways to help. You can go to our website, thethingsthatmattermost.org, where all our past shows are archived. While you're at our site, you can sign up for a weekly email reminder to tune into our next week's guest or hot topic. Finally, you can also sign up for an automatic download on iTunes, so without any effort, you'll always have the latest show on your iPod. So, archived shows, email reminders, and iPod subscriptions. Three ways to get our broadcasts if you miss us on Sunday morning. Thanks for listening. This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Still looking for a Christmas gift for that someone who likes to read? Or maybe for someone you'd like to invite to think about the things that matter most? Well, look no further. Go to Amazon and send them co-host Leah Larrington's brand new book, A Faith and Culture Devotional. Explore significant ideas, events, and people in short daily readings in science, history, art, literature, and contemporary culture. Well, they're supposed to be short daily readings, but once I started reading, I couldn't stop. I devoured the whole book as fast as I could. Now, you probably know from the show, I'm more of a science history kind of guy. But the doses of art and literature were good for me, too. Some of the world's greatest minds have contributed to Leah's book, including many of our radio guests on topics like string theory, dark matter, ancient empires, Paradise Lost, Plato, Picasso, and more. Great for a small group or book clubs or just by the coffee pot at work. For more information, see our website at thethingsthatmattermost.org or culturedevo.com. CulturedEvo.com.
Welcome back to The Things That Matter Most. This is Leah Larrington
and Sue Stewart,
and we're interviewing Dr. Arch Hart, author of Thrilled to Death, How the Endless Pursuit of Pleasure is Leaving Us Numb. And Dr. Hart, I appreciate so much the scientific research you've done in this area, your expertise in the scientific literature, and this in-depth look in your book and what goes on in our brains as we process pleasure. It's just fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But it did leave me wondering, though, is it all about our brains? Because,
mm-hmm.
As I mentioned before the break, we kind of love to continue the thread of previous conversations in a new interview, and we've interviewed both Eastern wellness author and medical doctor Deepak Chopra and Christian philosopher J.P. Moreland on our show, and they disagree about a lot, but they would agree on the statement that we don't feel pain or pleasure in our brains. We feel it in our consciousness, our souls, the material inner being, through the interface of the brain. How would you respond to them if you guys were out together over dinner?
Yeah, this is a very, very important point, and part of the disagreement is You know, it's true that we feel pain. I mean, ultimately, it becomes something in our consciousness. We know that. But that's just how wonderful the brain is. But one of the dangers here is it's called the mind-body problem, the dualism, where we separate the mind from the body or the mind from the brain, and we say, well, we feel this in our consciousness, but it has nothing to do with the brain, which really doesn't make sense. The dualism is, in my opinion, a bit of a curse because it keeps trying to make the case that it doesn't matter about your brain. It's what you are feeling that is important. But what we are feeling can only come from what is going on in the brain. Scientists today, I'm talking about hard-nosed scientists, are clearly having a better understanding of this connection between the brain and the mind and our feelings and emotions. And it's not one or the other. It is both and. You cannot have the one without the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the final analysis, our understanding of how the mind works can be much improved by understanding what is it that's going on in the brain.
Well,
tell you this, that you can feel no pleasure if we remove the pleasure system in your brain. No amount of mental activity on your part is going to give you any sense of pleasure whatsoever. The one is dependent on the other.
Yeah, I would think that at least J.P. Moreland would totally agree with you. He says, you know, your soul and your body are so deeply integrated that, you know, your soul, and he draws the analogy, your soul is perhaps, you know, picture a paintbrush painting on a canvas extended from a curtain. And if you look at it, that's all that you see, and you know that it's painting the picture, but unless you're in Disneyland, you know that there's a hand behind that curtain directing the brush. And they both need the other. And he says, if you take a piece of chalk and try to paint, do a picture, or if you take an ice pick and try to render a picture, then the quality of the picture is drastically reduced and diminished, but there's still the hand behind using the instrument of the body or the brain to render the picture. Would you think that that gives a picture of how the body and the mind, or the mind and the brain, work together?
That's a pretty good way of saying it. In other words, it's the mind what expresses itself. The mind is what is expressing itself,
mm-hmm.
and that's the sort of final product. But a part of the mechanism by which you get to that is the brain. And the only point I want to make is that if there can be, for example, in my book, I talk about the difference between happiness and pleasure, and there is a big difference between the two. You cannot have a happy mind without a healthy brain.
Right.
And that is the point I want to underscore.
Right. And so I guess the application of that where we live is, to what extent do you think the problem of anhedonia, that nothing feeling, is an issue of perhaps the life of our soul or our spiritual life with God? And to what extent might it be an issue of brain chemistry? Do I hear you saying it's very much both?
It is very much both. The one emerges out of the other. One is dependent on the other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Hurt, I have a question about that then, because I know that I can understand how chemicals of drugs can scientifically and chemically alter the brain's what the individuals begin to feel as a response, an emotional and physiological response to drugs. But I'm curious about how behaviors can also kick off a chemically similar experience of addiction in a person. I just find that, does that have something to do with the brain's experience of behaviors as opposed to drugs?
That's a very, very important question. It's something I cover in one of my other books called The Healing Life's Hidden Addictions, because the hard-nosed addiction scientists argue that for something to be addicting, it had to be a chemical of some sort.
Right, but then you speak about addictive behaviors.
Well, you only have
behaviors.
To look at gambling
right,
to debunk
right.
that theory. And in my in that book,
pornography.
Or pornography, for that, yes.
Right.
But in that, in my book, on that topic, I point out that behaviors are not just behaviors, period. They are behaviors also trigger within the brain many of its neurotransmitters, messengers. For example, certain behaviors, the reason why gambling is addicting is because of the adrenaline rush that
right,
the brain
okay.
becomes conditioned to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you see, in the final analysis, there is no behavior that can be addicting that does not also involve some sort of biochemical response in
right.
the body.
Right.
It comes back to dualism. When the moment we think dualistically that there is something that is separated from something else, we get into trouble because it's both and it's never one without the other. So the point there is that even behaviors will involve the brain's chemistry. Some of its it will go down into and will influence and affect the chemistry of the brain.
Well, we're talking with Dr. Arch Hart on his book Thrilled to Death, How the Endless Pursuit of Pleasure is Leaving Us Numb. Dr. Hart, in your book, you discuss five ways in which the pathways to the pleasure center of our brains can be disrupted. We're just talking about one, which is addiction. Can you mention some of the others, please?
Well, the pathway to the brain pleasure system can be affected by overstimulation. It can be affected by certain disorders. In other words, if you become depressed,
mm-hmm.
clinically depressed, one of the things clinical depression does is it shuts down the dopamine circuits. Dopamine is what you need for pleasure. So if you're clinically depressed, you will also be robbing yourself of any capacity to experience pleasure. And it is the one of the biological consequences of depression that will do it. But mostly what shuts down the pleasure system is the overuse of that system.
Mm-hmm. Well,
it doesn't get any rest. We need valleys to give meaning to mountains.
Right.
I grew up in South Africa where we were at 1 mile up, 5,000 feet, and there were not any mountains. But the reason there are no mountains is because where there were no valleys. And in a sense, the pleasure system of the brain works best when it is allowed to express itself in pleasure and then can go back to retreat back to a baseline of normal, low pleasure. And so it's the valleys and the mountains that really make for a healthy pleasure system.
Well, Dr. Hart, then I think we could probably all agree that the pleasure is technically a good thing, and that the valleys also give us a sense of balance there. But is there a difference between healthy pleasure and unhealthy pleasure? Can you delineate that a bit for us?
Yes, that is I think very, very important to understand. There are some pleasures that are healthy for the brain. Happiness, humor, let me say, anything that is funny, that can make us laugh. While it is stimulating to the brain and gets our juices going, is actually a very positive pleasure. It facilitates the healthy functioning of the brain. It improves our immune system function. It makes everything, it lowers our stress hormones. So there are pleasures that can be very, very pleasurable, that are very, very positive and healthy. And there are those pleasures that will abuse the systems of the brain, including and of the body, such as adrenaline of arousal and so on. An example would be someone who is addicted to exciting behaviors. I got a few friends who have to get their fix at least once a week. If it goes for a month, they don't get
an adrenaline fix. They have to get on their motorcycle, or
that's right. I mean, it could be a Harley Davidson. Another friend does his hang gliding. A third one is into bungee cord jumping. Have you any idea how
But every now and then, a little excitement is a good thing. So
yes,
what's the trick here? What's the trick?
The trick here is that in my book I talk about two types of pleasure: type A pleasure and type
right.
B pleasure. As in the personality types, type A, type B personalities. You know, type A personalities is a thrill seeker. You're always looking. You're always looking for thrills to give you pleasure. And I joke by saying that anything that has a computer chip in it is going to give you a type A pleasure. Because one of the dominant forms of pleasure today is coming from the internet. People will spend hours and hours on the internet because it gives them a lot of pleasure.
Now you're going from interviewing to meddling.
You know, multitasking. We haven't talked about that, but these are all ways of overstimulating the pleasure system of the brain.
Uh-huh.
Now, as opposed to type A, there's a group of pleasures I call type B. Type B pleasures, it's a sort of the type B personality. Anything that has nature involved, anything that has relationships involved, will be a type B pleasure. Though, no matter how pleasurable they are, they will always be healthy. And one of the problems today is that we are the gadgets that give us pleasure are also robbing us from relationships.
So Dr. Hart, the type B pleasures are always healthy?
The type B pleasures, there's nothing you can go and do in nature that is going to be
addictive or harmful. Okay.
Yeah, nothing. If you take a walk, go fishing, as long as you engage in nature. Our problem is that we have disengaged nature in a very, very profound way.
Mm-hmm.
And our excitement is not coming from natural things for which we are designed and built, but coming from the unnatural things that we have artificially created.
Now,
let me give you one example of this. You know, dad comes home and the other kid's sitting watching television. If dad said to them, kids, let's turn off that television set. I'm going to take a football and we're going to go outside and we're going to go and play with a football or play with, you know. And he took his kids out romping on the lawn, playing around. They could be screaming with laughter, having the biggest, you know, thrill of their life, and none of that would be damaging to their pleasure system.
But what about the hunting widows? It's early, it's that time of year, and I'm just thinking of a lot of women that sit at home while their husbands go out every weekend.
Well, that's the women. The men are having a great time. They're having a fabulous time with the type B pleasure.
You know, yeah. I mean, I'm wondering though, you're saying nothing in nature can be the wrong kind of pleasure. Maybe it's more a case of the kind of time we give to it. Would you make a distinction there, Dr. Hart?
Well, yes. You know, if you over-engage your fishing expeditions, you're going to have social consequences. It's going to be harmful to relationships. I pair nature with relationships. One of the saddest things about teenagers today, as several studies have shown, that what they want more than anything else is a more personal relationship with their parents. So it's not the one without the other, but I think both relationships and nature, and that's not to be the sole source of pleasure. I mean, I don't mind you getting pleasure from your computer. Be my guest. it's a matter of balancing these types of pleasure.
There's that word.
A healthy pleasure system.
Balance.
Yes, it really
there's
is.
That word.
It is a matter of balance. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's such a great thing to remember this time of year when we're thinking of things to do. Sometimes just the things that we do to go pick out a Christmas tree or just do those kinds of things that promote.
That's right.
Relationships to get out and go take popcorn to our neighbors or something like that.
Sure.
It can seem kind of hokey, but we take that step, we make that initiative, we move in that direction, and we're amazed to see the good things that result. Well, we're about due for a break. This is Leah Larrington
and Sue Stewart
on the Things That Matter Most with Dr. Arch Hart, author of Thrilled to Death: How the Endless Pursuit of Pleasure is Leaving Us Numb. Dr. Hart, do you have a website?
Yes, I do. www. heartinstitute.com.
And that's spelled H-A-R-T, no E.
H-A-R-T,
right.
Without the E.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment.
A child gets up on Christmas morning and finds no gift under the tree from Dad. Nothing. Dad's in prison, and you're a prisoner's child. That's the lonely Christmas morning that thousands of children across Texas face. Without Angel Tree and your generosity, interested in helping a child this Christmas, but not sure that one individual can really make a difference? John O'Reilly here to let you know how one person can make a big difference in the life of a family in need. Go to angeltreetexas.org and sign up today to help a child with a parent in prison. Your gift of love today will go a long way to giving a child a better tomorrow. Together, we can make a difference. Act now. angeltreetexas.org. Helping one child at a time. Giving hope.
Private parties, wedding receptions, business meetings. Main Street Crossing in Tomball is an awesome place to hold these events. Most advertisements are full of exaggeration, but this one is not. If there was a word that communicated better than the word unique, we'd use it. But we can't think of a better word. So if you go to MainStreetCrossing.com, you'll see for yourself that your friends and family will be wowed if you book your events there.
Welcome back to The Things That Matter Most. This is Lael Arrington
and Sue Stewart
in for Rick Davis today, who is on hiatus. And we're interviewing Dr. Arch Hart, author of Thrilled to Death, How the Endless Pursuit of Pleasure is Leaving Us Numb. Dr. Hart is a research psychologist and a practicing clinical psychologist as well. And we're so pleased to have you on the show.
Dr. Hart, during the break, you and I and Lael were discussing the role of the soul.
Yes.
And the wonderful quote by C.S. Lewis, when he said, "I don't have a soul, I am a soul." I just love that. I'm curious, from a scientist standpoint, how does a soul, experience happiness, and how would a soul define happiness, or what part does a soul play in the experience of happiness?
The fascinating thing for me about the whole happiness issue is that there is no part of the brain that delivers happiness as such. We have a pleasure system, and that has to be functioning properly if we're going to experience happiness. But happiness comes from a much larger perspective that can only come from what we refer to as the soul, is the experience of the whole brain, everything that's going on in it.
So would you say that pleasure is experienced by the brain, but happiness is experienced by the soul?
That would be a very acceptable way of saying it. Mm. Yes, mm-hmm. But happiness has to do with how do I interpret that pleasure? Something gives me pleasure, but I have to put a value on that. When I have having pleasure because I'm with my grandchildren and I'm enjoying their relationships and their love and their appreciation and all of that, I bring my whole mind to put a value on that. And so happiness is a much more profound experience, and it takes more than a brain to provide it.
Well, Dr. Hart, I so much enjoyed reading about your trip with your grandsons to Switzerland, and one of the great moments in the book is when, to your surprise, when you give your grandsons an opportunity to choose their favorite spot to return to, they don't choose the Eiffel Tower or the
nope.
you know or any other exciting aspect of all of Europe that was their
not even the Colosseum.
No, they want to go back and feed a little pony that they befriended at some point in their travels. And that reminded me of the early days of my own motherhood and the time that I spent with my children. And I'm an English teacher, and my children had to memorize lots of poetry. And one of the poems that they memorized was Wordsworth's "I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud."
In the cloud.
as a cloud. And the last stanza of that talks about a pleasure and the memory of pleasure. It goes, when oft upon my couch I lie in vacant or in pensive mood, they flash upon that inward eye, which is the bliss of solitude. And then my heart with pleasure fills and dances with the daffodils. And the poet's referring to a moment when he rounded a curve and saw these beautiful thousands of daffodils lining a lake, and he's actually remembering that moment of the initial actual experience of pleasure, and the memory itself returns just almost as much pleasure as he had in the actual experience. And I'd like for you to speak a little bit about the power of memory, and also about the power of, you have a whole chapter in your section on ways to rebalance unhealthy pleasure with healthy pleasures. And could you talk to us a little bit about these, the simple pleasures, finding the simple pleasures, and what some examples of those things are, and how we can incorporate those into our lives?
Yes, it is interesting that you mentioned the issue of memory, because that's one of the strategies that I put forward in my book to help you recover your pleasure system. In other words, you've got to balance things and make sure that you keep that system healthy. And one of the ways you can do that is through your memory, by reliving, recalling and reliving happier times, pleasurable times. I also tell a story in the book, I think, about my experiences early in my life with my grandfather, when he would take me fishing with just a piece of string on the end of a stick, you know. Mm. But how I can help to develop a balanced and pleasure system by recalling through my memory and deriving pleasure through my memory, that helps to heal my pleasure system.
Well,
it is very, very powerful. And happiness is, to some extent, it is derived from the memory of things more than from the experience of the thing in that moment. I have on many occasions.
Does science show that, have there been scientific experiments that show that memory can deliver the chemical, the dopamine, just
yes.
as a actual, so there really is a scientific basis for the pleasure that memory
yes.
brings us?
Absolutely, that by just simply in your imagination recalling happy events, you not just that, you see, that dopamine is only one part of the whole mechanism. There's a complex system of many other biochemicals in the brain, and when you use your memory to relive a pleasurable experience, you're also lowering your adrenaline. You're lowering your cortisol. It has a it is very difficult, even from a scientific point of view, to identify all of the positive things that go on in your brain.
Well, can you give us a list?
From the simple act of recalling something that was happy earlier in your life.
As you mentioned the cortisol and stuff, I'm thinking of stress, and I'm thinking how this
yes.
time of year is an incredibly stressful time of
right.
year. And so, just very briefly, how does stress chemically affect our pleasure systems?
Stress elevates cortisol. Cortisol blocks the production of dopamine. It's
mm-hmm.
as straightforward as that.
And so that's another reason for going and just slowing down and taking some of the simple pleasures more seriously
oh, yes.
and rebooting our brain, so to speak, so that we give it time to get off the cortisol and get overstimulated.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, Dr. Hart, you've got a wonderful list of suggestions in the application part of your book about how to boost your pleasure and hopefully enhance the experience of happiness. Can you give us a sort of a recap of the three main pleasure boosters that you recommend in your book?
Yes. Well, there are several strategies. The one I think is that one has to develop a sense of gratitude. What is very big in psychology these days is the ability to be grateful for things, to be content about things, to be able to count your blessings, to be able to appreciate things. And in my book, I pick up on some of these strategies. For example, to get into the habit of practicing on a daily basis how to be appreciative, to end your day by sort of sitting down and counting your blessings, identifying three things that you are really grateful for that day, and to focus on building the sense of how can I say it? It's like putting your brain into a ball of real deep gratitude, contentment, and appreciation. Because the part of the problem with our overexcitement in this world of ours, and you know, as we go into Christmas, and you think of all the bigger and better presents you've got to buy this time, you should just pause and ask yourself, what can I give to someone that can help them appreciate more, be more grateful for, can be more of a blessing to them, than something that's just going to make them excited for 5 minutes and then they're going to throw it away. And it really comes from expressing ourselves through in our relationships, doing things that will help to bond our relationship closer with those that we love.
So many, a thing I noticed about the suggestions that you have, Dr. Hart, for boosting our pleasure, they're free, they're simple, they're universally accessible to anyone. Another suggestion that you have is the trick of relaxation and sleep, those two things. Everyone can do that. Can you talk a little bit about ways to relax?
I think so. This is not just one tiny little piece of your being. This is vital to your whole being. And relaxation, yes, I'm a strong proponent of relaxation. Meditation, I think meditation is profoundly beneficial to our happiness and our pleasure system, and the reason is very simply because they help to lower our stress hormones. And the problem with excitement, why it is a dangerous drug, is because even though it's a positive thing rather than a negative thing, it is in fact it does also elevate your stress hormones and turns your body into a stress machine.
So excitement is stressful.
Excuse me?
So excitement is stressful?
Yes. What you're doing is if you raise adrenaline, you're also raising cortisol. And anything that raises adrenaline and cortisol is stressful, even if it's so-called good things of your life.
Well, your last chapter is entitled Make Space for the Things That Matter. I think that's a great title, Art.
Yeah.
You gotta love it. And so here on our show, The Things That Matter Most, just leave us maybe with just a last minute and a half or so. How do we make space for the things that matter most in our life?
We've got to make room for the love in our lives with the family members, with people who are going to be lonely this Christmas, or the ones who really need to be pitied. And I would encourage anyone who is going to be lonely this Christmas to make sure that they do make room for relationships. There are other people who are lonely also. Just go and reach out to them. Mm. Make room for your friendships. Make room for your family. Make room for forgiveness. That's another powerful tool. Many are carrying resentment, carrying hurts. And at Christmas time, interestingly, these surface. They come to the surface because you tend to remember things from your past. So make room for forgiveness. Let go of your grudges, and make room for some disappointment. One of the things, the big mistakes we can make is to think that everything is going to turn out fine, when in fact that is not life. And most of us are going to have to spend some time in grief this Christmas.
Mm.
And that is all part of making room for the things that matter most.
Well, Dr. Hart, you have given us a wonderful interview, and we so recommend your book, Thrilled to Death, How the Endless Pursuit of Pleasure is Leaving Us Numb, to anyone who would like to think more and reflect more and tap into a lot of the very practical advice that Dr. Hart offers in his book. We thank you so much for being on The Things That Matter Most.
Thank you, Dr. Hart.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And this is Leah Larrington with Sue Stewart. We'll be back in a moment.
How many Texans go hungry? In one of the wealthiest, most agriculturally rich states in the nation, over 3.1 million people in Texas don't always know where they will get groceries or money for their next meal.
I'm Alonzo Highsmith, spokesperson for the New Kid Care. The faces of hunger vary. Many of these people are children or the elderly. They may be Caucasian, African American, Hispanic, or Asian. Now that you know who these people are, here's how you can help.
Here in Houston, the New Kid Care provides lunches to more than 900 children every day. Our emergency food pantry is available for people to visit. As the New Kid Care grows, so does our clothing bank.
Please consider helping us build this program with your financial support. You can do that by going online at thenewkidcare.com or by calling 713-695-5437.
The New Kid Care. It's working here in Houston.
This is Leah Larrington with Sue Stewart on The Things That Matter Most. And we're back from interviewing Dr. Arch Hart, Thrilled to Death.
Lael, you know, when I read this book, the thing that kept running in the back of my head was Mick Jagger and the song from our youth, I Don't Get No Satisfaction. And I was so happy to read, though, that there are some real ways to get some satisfaction. I know you've got some thoughts, too, about
Yeah, you know, that. I kept thinking so many times, at least on my own journey, what I've learned is, my great challenge is to learn to value and delight in what is truly the most meaningful and the greatest source of joy. And my trouble is that I don't tend to value the things that bring the most joy, and I spend my time chasing after them.
Because the real things are right under our nose.
That's
They're
right.
They're so obvious.
That's right. And we don't treasure them. We don't treasure our relationships. We don't treasure our time with God. It's much easier to even read a book about God than to just be quiet before Him and reach out for His love and His peace and His fellowship. I felt like it was a great reminder to look for the simple pleasures, the quieter times, ever since I wrote this book, I've been turning off the TV a little bit and just reading, not multitasking quite as
right.
much, and my nerves aren't as jangled. It really is true. So, I don't know, you're probably jetting around out there Christmas shopping or off for a day.
Or feeling guilty about not Christmas shopping like me.
Yeah, and so we just wish for you during this Christmas season some time to really pull back, get into some of those valleys. Ask your kids, what's the greatest thing you enjoy about Christmas? And maybe focus on that, not so much on all the other activity. And have a wonderful time this Christmas. We wish you the very merriest Christmas as you take the time to treasure and value the things that matter most.